Good afternoon, everybody. Yay, thank you so much. I'm Natalie Wood. I'm an NCSLer. I direct our Center for Legislative Strengthening. What that means is my team and I handle all things legislative institution, and that includes telling the story of state legislatures. So I'm thrilled to be up here as your fearless moderator with our panelists this afternoon. As a note to those of you in the audience, when we get to the question part of this session, we're being live streamed, so it's really important that you go up to the microphone that's here when you want to speak to Donna and Ben. I'm extremely pleased to be up here with Donna Washington, who, as we learned yesterday, can sing. And she likes Scooby-Doo. But more importantly, she's a world-class, award-winning master storyteller and educator. She's also a celebrated author. And I'm carrying around a copy of her latest book, Boo Soup, Totally Fangirling Donna, which I hope she'll sign after the session. Ben Sawyer's position on Scooby-Doo is unknown, but he does admit to liking Bugs Bunny quite a bit. He's a senior instructor of history at Middle Tennessee State University, and he's a stand-up comedian, a trivia quizmaster, and co-host of the fantastic podcast Road to Now, which I highly encourage you to check out if you haven't already. And I happen to know Ben has been on 2 cross-country trips with family already this summer, is that right? So if we can make one assumption about him, it's that he's a very patient man. Donna and Ben, as many of you know, are no strangers to NCSL Summit. To this stage, they've joined us in Nashville and Tampa, and I'm hoping that the applause we give them right now in Denver will be their most rousing yet. So please join me in welcoming Donna and Ben. Thank you. As you know, Donna was here with us yesterday, and the point of this session is to allow some dialogue with the audience, because we didn't get to do that yesterday. I'm going to ask some questions. I have some, of course, primed that they've gotten to check out already that I get to ask because I have the microphone, but I hope that when it comes time to turn to you, you guys have been thinking of some things and are ready to ask them because they're ready to talk back and listen. The first question I want to ask is for Donna. Donna, there are 5,000 people at this meeting. Yesterday, you were the only thing standing between us and a reception. And no one left the room. I was watching. I was by the door. Your stories captivated us. Can you walk us through some of the mechanics of how you put those stories together? How do you construct a proper beginning, middle, and end and keep people in the seats?
Well, we did talk about some of this yesterday in session. But ideally, when you want a story to really hit an audience, no story you tell is about you. Because everyone likes to hear about themselves, am I right? Like, can you tell me more about me? So when you tell a story, the first thing you have to do is be aware of what the audience, who you're going to be talking to, who you're going to be speaking to. And a lot of times you can know this if they have signed up particularly. And you guys were easy. You're all in politics. So find out what your audience, who your audience is. And then once you figure that out, you have to figure out how you connect to that audience. So those are the first really key things. And then you have to figure out what your intent is. When you are telling a story, it's good to know what it is you're after. If you know what you're looking for out of an audience, or you know what kind of response you want, it helps you figure out what to put into that story. So you start the story by making a personal connection or making some kind of a connection with the audience, and that's how you begin it. But you also begin it with understanding that you want to move to the end, right? So you know where you want to go. So set us up to get to the end. Yesterday, when I started my presentation, we did We the People. We sang the Schoolhouse Rock song. And then I just recited it at the very end. I knew I was going to do that before I started, obviously. It's a circular thing. It brings you back to where we started. And the whole point of it is, this is where America started, really. This is where our government began, with this agreement about how we want to run the country. So I know that's what I'm going to do. The middle of this story is all about connecting my original thoughts with how I want to end it. So the middle of the story moves you through whatever points I'm going to make, if I'm going to try to explain something or teach something, or if I'm getting feedback to learn something. The middle of that story is the action of that story. How does all of this work together? And of course, the end for me is tying all of the ideas back together so that you do have a beginning, middle, and an end that actually speak to each other. There is nothing worse than getting to the end of a speech and you're kind of going, was that it? And if you don't tie things back together from the beginning, people lose track of where you started. And if you know what you're trying to say, then you have a better idea of what goes in the speech or the story and what does not go in there. That's also something that I find annoying, where you're listening and there's this long section that goes nowhere and it's about nothing and it's just stuck in there. So understanding what your intent is helps a lot.
Ben, you want to jump in on this at all? Any feedback or advice?
Well, the stories that I tell in my classroom are historical stories, and the same things that we share on my podcast and a lot of comedy comes from history stories, you know, that I do. But I think it's constantly going back to those things that you find common ground on. You know, when people come in to my history classes, I go, who knows anything about George Washington? And they're like, he's the first president. And I'm like, what else? They're like, he was a general. I'm like, but we consider him to be great. Why? And somebody goes, because he was the first president? And I'm like, I bet all you guys could close your eyes right now and imagine a president you don't much like. So does being the president make you awesome? You know? But I go back to it, and they don't really know why. And so if you can unwrap, you know, with teaching, you can uncrack that mystery, right? Why do we all say he's great, but we don't know why? And then I explain to them why. I won't do that here, but, you know, it's his humility and his ability to master power. And that doesn't seem like a surprise. It doesn't seem like a heroic trait, but, you know, the lack of corruption, as you guys know, tends to, you know, be a rare trait. We often find ourselves talking ourselves into stories in our head about why what we're doing is okay. And so I think, for me, when I'm in the classroom, I'm up against the fact that they've been told a story. They've all got some kind of story that they've heard over and over and over again. And so when I'm trying to tell them the story about why these people do matter, and they do, I'm constantly going back to what have I surprised you with, and where do we find the humanity in the person? And if you ever go off script and you just start going, and then he was, you know, mom with courthouse, he made a mistake, like they're just like, what? But then you make it human, and for me, when I'm telling history stories, and I think it applies to anything, right? You constantly come back to what's the common theme. Kurt talked about it today. I mean, these two big themes of suffering and of love. And I think that when you consider your audience and you keep with that, it works.
My kids know him from that musical with Lin-Manuel Miranda. Yeah. Best.
It's pretty good.
Yeah.
Ben, so talking about history and talking about how you tell tales from history, this involves a lot of nuance a lot of the time and perspectives. How do you make tales from history compelling when most people just want to hear the quick and dirty version from Twitter or TikTok? I mean, how do you capture the attention of people that way?
Natalie, I just want to say, she sent me like some ideas for questions for today, and I sat for hours and thought about this. Because it's like, how do you compete with Twitter and TikTok? And I kept on being like, well, the first thing I should say is that, like, legally I'm responsible to tell you guys, do not get your history from TikTok or your investing advice. Or anything but maybe a hairdo. You know, I don't know what else they do on there. It's a bad place to get, you know, general information. But it's like this question of, are they in competition? I mean, I think that those mediums can be useful for us. Those media can be useful for us as historians if we can catch somebody off guard. But, you know, having to abide by rules and ethics whenever you're trying to convey information puts you at a disadvantage versus people who go, bah, see this? It's the end of the world. So that's a problem. But I think that the question is, how do you make it compelling when other people want these short things? I think the best response is that history is compelling. And I don't think those things are. I mean, they're fleeting, right? I mean, don't we all agree on this? I feel like everybody I talk to that's staring at these things is going, it's vapid. It's fleeting, it's momentary. I don't know if you guys have ever had a friend who had a tweet go viral. The person's like on top of the world, and then a week later, nobody remembers them. Just trying to capture the magic again, getting 5 likes, 1 retweet. Where in the meantime, like the story itself that we have, it belongs to all of us. And it's worth sharing. And we've been sharing it for generations. And I think more than ever, history might be compelling just because we live so much of our world in social media and in kind of the bigger picture where everything's divided down the middle and you have to pick this one side or the other. And in a world where everybody has to be a 1 or a 0, history is a place that gives you permission to be human. And you find those stories and people. And I think that, you know, in a way that literature can provide, history itself, finding times when things were hard, right? I mean, everybody thinks that things are hard in their lifetime. Some people are definitely right about peasants, for sure. Definitely it was hard for them. I agree with them on that. But every generation feels like they've got the weight of history on their shoulders, because they do. Finding people who lived in that environment, you know, even stories about, you know, famous people just doing just regular things, you know, you go, oh, they were human beings. And I think that humanizes it for you and makes it accessible in a way. But I think also, I mean, just the big picture is it is compelling, and it is something that's more permanent. And I think that as more and more of us, as I certainly have, and probably a lot of you have, if you're like anything like the people that I'm around, you get tired of that constant reinforcement that relies on some kind of a story that we all really know isn't as severe as it's being made out to be. I think history actually has like a great opening now, because there's so much there to learn from. Mm-hmm.
Donna, what's your take on social and the ability to storytell there?
Well, something kind of interesting happened over the pandemic. That is, I am an in-person live performer. That's how I make a living. And then I couldn't do that. So in 24 hours, my entire bottom line just disappeared. And storytellers, live performers from all over the country are going, what? How are we gonna survive this? And so we made the jump to being online. And it was not an easy thing, because if you're looking at a box and talking, you're not telling stories to anybody. Even if 80 people are on the other side watching you, you're just telling stories to yourself. Really not very rewarding experience. When I think about the difference between social media and being live with someone after having spent 2 years performing on camera, I can say that the thing about TikTok and YouTube and all the socials is you get a bite of something, but you don't engage with something. You get a snippet of something, and it might be funny, it may make you laugh, but it doesn't sit inside of you. Not the same way a story can, which is actually constructed to be part of how you sort of understand the world. At one point, I was doing an hour-long story set with middle schoolers, Greek mythology. So I was doing Greek myths. And it's a lot of fun. It goes with their history class and their English classes. I'm finished. I got an email from a parent saying, this is the first time since this pandemic began that my kid enjoyed a day of school. And it started because she started the day with those stories. And it just helped her get all the way through the day. There is something very different about having a bite of something and having an in-depth experience. And storytelling pings all the things in our brains that tells us we're people and that we're connected in a way that bites on social media do not.
What I think about what's really interesting about what you just said is we've had two sessions at least that I've been in for quite a bit of or dropped in on social media. And what I've been hearing from some of our members is it's an engagement tool. And what I'm hearing you say is,
Well, it can get you in the door, mm-hmm. right? But it can't immerse you in anything.
Yeah, does that hit the audience? What do you think about that? Yes.
So.
I mean, I think there's a lot of storytelling going on Facebook. And the story goes, somebody posts something, and then somebody they know from like their childhood goes, you're a fascist.
I didn't say that, Ben. Okay.
No, I know. I'll tell you. My dad's always fighting. He's warring with people he went to elementary school with. It's exhausting, honestly. Because you can silence him on Facebook, but you can't silence him at dinner, and he's going to tell you about it. Or, you know, of course you think I'm a fascist, you're a communist. You know what I'm saying? It's like, and that is, to me, like, what's worrying about these things is that, like, you have a person who's lived a complex life, they've struggled, they've loved, they've lost, they have children, you know, they're worried about their bills, And then all at once, they're just a stupid idiot fascist. You know what I'm saying? And that to me is like the essence of like what storytelling is on there. I'm going to tell you what your story is. It's real dumb. All right? Now shut up.
Well, we call that drive-by storytelling.
Drive-by storytelling.
I feel the same way about the moth, though, unfortunately. Like, find the most terrible thing that's ever happened to you and then tell everybody.
Yeah, that's right. And then they clap.
And then it's like drive-by storytelling. It's when you aren't telling a story because you're trying to touch anyone. You're telling a story to wallow in yourself as hard as you can. It's voyeurism at the worst.
Don, I once did a local moth, and I told a funny story. I lost so bad. I lost so bad. The other people were so sad in their stories, and it didn't work for me. So.
Well, I met the guy that runs the moth and made it up, that started it. He came to a national storytelling event, and he explained how he put it together, and we were just like, we should drown you like a kitten. Sorry, it was just annoying.
But what I want to say about all of this is that, like, it's just set up so that when someone says something you don't like,
you can yell
instead
at.
Of engaging the actual person or the content, you can just go, you're dumb, and then just disappear. You know what I'm saying? And I guess it makes you feel validated about yourself. I've never seen one person who was like, you know, had posted on Facebook, like, you know, thanks for everybody telling me I was an idiot. I realized it, and now I'm going to do what they want. Like, it doesn't work.
Who's it for? Look, this is why Flat Earth lives on YouTube.
Oh, yes, it does.
No, all the conspiracy theories. If you really want to get into some conspiracy theories, go check out Facebook. I personally think they're very funny, but there are people going, yes, you're speaking the truth. I'm like, who are you?
Yeah, it's a really low bar these days, too. Yeah. As a storyteller, have you ever, like, kind of tempted to make one up?
Like
a conspiracy theory.
I talked to someone who told me that these kids made up a conspiracy theory that the birds are all fake.
Yeah, they did.
I heard about that for the first time. I'm totally going to go look that up. I'm going to get a shirt that says, you're watching the birds. The birds are also watching you.
Also, can I just say this last thing on conspiracy theories? If you haven't done this yet, before you leave here, if you're flying out, make sure to go to YouTube and look up the Denver Airport conspiracy. Yeah. Have you guys heard about this?
About that horse?
That's true. Lucifer. Yeah. His name is Lucifer.
Lucifer. Someone sent that to me.
It just relies on people not understanding anything about history or cities. It goes, they had a perfectly good airport in the middle of the city, but then they decided to build one outside of the city. Why would they do that if not building a bunker that Princess Diana lives in? And you're like...
Okay, one more. The Jackie Torrance, she's this legendary storyteller, and she says that when she was alive back in the day, she was living in the town where they quarried Elvis's tomb from. Like, they quarried it out, it's like some major rock. She says, I saw it. He's in there. There are people in the audience came up, I'm sure he's still alive. You can't do anything about that. Those people are just there.
Well, I always try. That's my fault. Yeah.
All right. I'm going to get this back on track. It's my job. But it was fun going down that path.
I'm sorry.
About Lucifer. Right. I want to go back to what you said about you became a virtual storyteller with a lot of reluctance, it sounds like. And our members are now doing the same thing. You have to have constituent town halls virtually, and staff are helping them do this. Mm-hmm. And you're still on a stage a lot of the time. So, what different strategies do you need to think about if you do at all? You know, what's some advice you have for folks who are now trying to engage in different ways all the time to make an impact?
Okay, the first thing is this. If you are not good at staring at the camera, put like a little figurine right above where you're supposed to be looking and look at that thing. Otherwise, it looks like you're doing this. It's just, and then people are wondering what you're looking at, okay? So if you're not good at it, put something right there on the camera. That's the first thing. Second thing, imagine the most receptive, blissful, joyful audience you can imagine. Imagine all your jokes are landing like perfectly. Imagine everyone's going, yes, that's exactly what I wanted to hear. Imagine that they are loving every second and play to that audience. Play to the best audience that ever was while you're looking at that camera. If you do that, even though you're not talking to anybody, because you're just on the camera, the people in the audience will feel like you really understand them. This is something that I studied theater and did some film back in the day. And when I started doing virtual storytelling, that's one thing I noticed. When you have people who are just telling for themselves, it looks like that. If you're just talking to yourself, it looks like that. But if you are playing to an audience, it looks like that as well. So that's the biggest tip I have. You're not talking to the camera. You are talking to, I don't know, a room full of joyful grandchildren or something, whatever it is you need.
Who's a podcaster in here? Whose caucus has one or who's doing it? Raise your hand. Be proud so Ben can see. What advice do you have for those podcasters out there, Ben? Who do you talk to when you're... Bob, hopefully.
Yeah, I talk to Bob a lot. Mm-hmm. This is weird ones where we don't talk to each other. Me and my co-host, we're just ignoring each other like a bad family relationship. So I think the thing with a podcast is know your audience and know why you're there. Ask yourself, like, who wants to hear this? And stick with that. And it's slow growth. And I'm sure if you're doing a legislative podcast, I mean, there's a cap on the number of people that are going to be listening to it. Make sure it's good for them. I mean, I've talked to people who have networks where I was talking to a guy and he was like, we brought in this one podcast these guys wanted to do, and it was something like cooking in ancient Babylon or something like this. And they were like, okay. It turns out there's 300 people who are way into that. And they're like that, 300 on every episode. And now these folks have found a community at which they can speak around, and it gives them something to talk about, right? So you can create community with it. Another thing with podcasts that I've said for a long time, because it's like a joke in the stand-up comedy world, it's like, oh, another comic with the podcast. What a surprise. And it kind of got like that for a while, where it was just like everybody has a podcast. That never deterred me. It never made me say don't have one, because sometimes the great thing about doing a podcast is like, how many of you guys know somebody that you'd really like to have a good conversation with? Somebody you work with, right? Somebody that has wisdom, and you keep on saying, oh yeah, let's grab lunch sometime, but it never gets on the schedule. If you create a podcast, even if barely anybody listens, it doesn't matter. If you take it seriously, you'll set up some microphones and you'll put it in a calendar and you'll have that conversation. And even if nobody ever listens to it, you've got value out of that. And that can build relationships. And I got to know a lot of people in Nashville because they were like, hey, will you come be on my podcast? And that's just kind of cool because you get to know your community better. And then when something comes up and they, you know, you can help each other out, you know who that is. And I think that's got to be true of folks in legislatures as well, where you work in this community that's constantly, there's pressure on you, right? There's different committees. So I don't know. That would be my advice, would be know why you're doing it and understand that there's value in it aside from the number of people listening.
Have you heard of the Building Democracy podcast yet?
I have not.
Shameless plug. It's an NCSL podcast about the history of
legislatures. Oh, yeah, that one's awesome.
Thanks.
You said Building Democracy. That's my favorite
one. Should have worked that out better before.
Love that one. The virtual storytelling thing, if I could add something to that, because this was my life in 2020, was just a tornado missed my house by a block and a half. We lost power for like 9 days. We got the power back on at noon, and I was like, finally, things are back to normal. And 2 hours later, everybody called, and we're like, everything's closed now. And we were like, oh, so COVID was real. You know, it was like, we didn't know. We'd heard about it, and then we lost power. So we were helping our neighbors, and it was a bizarre moment. But then you just had to adjust. And suddenly you were teaching these students, and so many of them just got thrown back into their homes and places that didn't have, solid internet connections. And they can't give me enough students. I have like 200 students. And I was worried about them. Some of them I didn't see anymore. But what I started doing was, I gradually throughout the time we were off, like the first semester I had to work with what was there. All the AV stuff was sold out. So like I built a desk. There's this piece of wood. Anybody here got like a piece of plywood out on the porch? Your wife's like, when are you ever going to use that? And you're like, I will. You'll see. You guys know what I'm talking about? I brought it inside and built a stand-up desk out of it. And I like mounted some stuff on it. It eventually became this what I called my redneck studio. It used to be a bedroom. It was like a green screen hanging from some like curtain rods behind me, like cameras, lighting and everything. And then the thing, and this is my advice, if you're regularly talking to groups of people, this is what changed it for me. I bought a 34-inch ultra wide monitor and I put it in front of me and where I could stand up, and I put it eye level with the camera on top of it. And the great thing about that was suddenly you could see everybody's face. These 30 people at a time, really. But they're the size of like an iPhone screen sideways. And what was great about that is you could read them in this, not in the same way you can in person, because you can't feel that energy. But you could definitely see if they were doing something else. I mean, this was the greatest moment because I'm pretty sure like most of the professors in America were just in front of a 13-inch MacBook, like looking at their slides. I had my slides on a monitor over here. In front of me, I had this monitor, and you didn't want to, like, you'd tell them that, be like, hey, I got this monitor, I can see you. They don't ever hear anything on the first day. So you just wait till like the day one of week two, and you're just talking, and you stop, and you go, hey, Leslie, what you eating? Looks good. You don't look happy about it. Are you okay? And then she, like, stops, and then everybody else stops, like, can you see us? Yeah, I can see you. And that, to me, was like a game changer in these classrooms where they knew that I had 30 students in my classes. So it was like, I knew that, and they felt like they were there. So I know sometimes there'll be more than that. Don't let them know that, okay? Let them think you can see all of them. But even that dynamic, it felt like you're performing. Even if you couldn't hear, they would always mute themselves.
I think for you virtual committee chairs out there, that is probably a decent strategy too. Who's had to chair a virtual session or committee?
Yeah. Well, in our world, they turn the cameras off. See, I'm not teaching students. I got grown-ups who can decide if they want to be seen or not. And so they turn their cameras off. You have no idea what they're doing. You just got to assume they're listening to you.
Well, yeah.
Especially since half of them paid for the price to be there. But I was thinking about, you know, talking about setting up studios. That was something that we had to definitely learn. I'm lucky in that since I came out of the theater world, I knew a lot of people who did lighting design, set design, and sound design. So I just called people and went, what do I need to do? And so I was late on the sort of like, how do you get it set up? I couldn't get a webcam. I bought a video camera, like, you know, like camcorder, old school camcorder. And then I use my ironing board because you can adjust it. And so I set my ironing board up. We bought, I ordered a backdrop stand. I bought a fake bookcase that I put there that looks really good on camera. And then I bought a couple of chairs, and occasionally I just hike my ironing board all the way up and stand up depending on what I'm doing. And what I would do is I would record it while I was on Zoom or whatever, and then I would then use the recording afterwards. Like there's a stick in the camera, so I'd take the memory card out of the camera, and then I would upload the camcorder, which was actually better quality because it's a fabulous camcorder. So I would actually use the recording I made from the camcorder, not the one from Zoom.
Yeah, I think, Donna, like in all of this, it's like you go, this is different. And you know it's different, but there's two things. First of all, is if you are going to speak in front of people and you haven't really thought about who the audience is and what the environment is, I mean, anytime you're speaking, you have to. Those are the two things you have to clue in on. If you're going to be a pro about this, you just go up and give the same talk to everybody else. If you want to convey information, you have to think, who's in front of me? Where are we going to be? In this room, you walked in and the chairs told you where to face. You know what I'm saying? Like when you're at home, it's reasonable that in that environment, somebody's going to walk in and start asking you what you want for lunch, right? You can't break with that. It happens in people's houses. But I think those fundamentals, and for me, what helped was, you know, immediately you think, what can't I do? Especially when you've been doing something a long time. What is this stopping me from doing? And I realized, I was like, that's useless. What I've got to think about is, what can I do here that I couldn't do other places? And what do my students now need in this environment? And doing breakout sessions was the biggest one, because we lack community. And I put them in breakout sessions, and, you know, I would jump into them, you know, like pop in. I'd ruin it for them. They'd be having a great conversation, and somebody just stop and go, OMG, he's here. I'd just be like, who's here? But it was great, and you found that. And so what can we do? That's the attitude to have. And so what does this platform enable you to do? And that's specific to what you're trying to convey and who you're speaking with.
All right, well, one more thing. Yeah. We're one more thinging each other. One of the things that happened for me, over the pandemic is that I actually ended up co-founding a 501c3 called Artists Standing Strong Together. And the whole point of it is, like, independent artists especially have no community. Like, we gather when we can, but mostly we're working all over by ourselves. And so we didn't have a water cooler to hang out with. So we created a space where we could all meet and talk and have programs together and work together. So, and it's still going on. We've discovered that our community needed that and we didn't even know. One of the things that will happen with Zoom and talking to your constituents is you have way more access to them than you had before, because before you would have to go and find them, and now you can make a place for them to come. So using Zoom for access, which is what we have done with Artists Standing Strong Together, would be a really good benefit of using virtual spaces with your constituents.
Thanks, good advice. Ben, you popped into our session this morning called Out of the Bunker and Into the Conversation. One of the parting thoughts of that session was about how legislative staff can work with legislators. We were talking about civility and bipartisanship in that room. I've heard both of you say that what makes a great storyteller is making connection by being personal, finding the personal. But where are my nonpartisan legislative staff in the room? So often the job of these legislative staff, and there are partisan staff in legislatures too, but the nonpartisan staff need to stay neutral. So how can you tell a compelling story to get your point across when you have to keep the personal kind of private?
Well, the one thing I would say is that when we talk about personal stories, they don't have to be stories about one's own individual self. I think the power of a personal story is taking something bigger and putting it into the life of someone and making that clear. Because again, once you get down to the basics of an individual, you can find, you know, where their love is, where their suffering is. We can understand them on an individual level. They cease to be some kind of a mass of people or a mob. And I think that to me would be, you know, look at Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan, I mean, incredible storyteller, right? He would bring up individuals and tell stories, not stories that he could have told himself, but he used those stories to convey emotion, to convey empathy and things like that. And so when you look back at that, to me, when we were talking about this before, it's like that to me is the model. Make it personal, explain how it affects an individual person instead of kind of the numbers of things. And I think that works for everything. As a teacher, I love economic history. I tried to explain American history in numbers for about one lecture. And they were just like falling over dead. And I was like, you guys are pretty good. This might be my fault, you know?
Just like yesterday when I started the whole thing with a story that wasn't about me, that was about a friend of mine. And it was a story that all of us could relate to on one level or another because it's a story about people. So people need the same basic stuff, no matter who they are. Start with that, the stuff that's people. And you don't have to worry about partisan, even if you're a Democrat, sometimes you must sleep. Sometimes you must eat. If you're a Republican, sometimes you must, go to the restroom. Everybody's got the same needs. So if you want to reach out to people across bipartisan issues, start with where the human element is, because that's the thing that's really important here, not where your party is.
Thanks, Donna. We've been talking a lot about history, and something you said yesterday was, I've been kind of turning it over, and that's about how lawmakers need to communicate their plans, which to me is storytelling about the future. So I'm kind of curious about, is it easier for you to tell a story based on history, or is it easy to tell a future story, or do you need to think about different things when you're trying to tell either one?
The hardest part about telling future stories is you have to imagine stuff that's not here. It's always easier to tell stories about the past, which is why so many lawmakers do the whole, American mythology thing, where we're trying to get back to some imaginary, better time. And I think I was really clear about what that's like yesterday for people of color, right? And we're not going anywhere. It is harder to do it. But if you have plans, if you actually have things you want to accomplish, then ideally you're trying to get somewhere. So think about tying in the choices you're making about the plans you want to make with where you want to go. So, that's, by 2023, we want to, have accomplished this. And then you have a plan to get there. If you don't have a plan and you make some random, by 2025, we want to be on the moon again and we're going to build spaceships up there. Yeah? How are you going to do that? You need a plan. And if your plan will take you into the future. But American mythology of what's in the past. Why was George Washington a great president? Because he was.
Number one.
But going back to a mystical American past that doesn't exist anywhere except on Leave It to Beaver, don't do that. Though that's the easiest way.
Yeah, this is something that struck me. Actually, Don and I were talking earlier. Have you guys read Yuval Noah Harari's Sapiens? Anybody read this book? It's a pretty amazing book. It's about, the way that human beings are storytellers. The book's called Sapiens. If you haven't read it, it's mind-blowing, written by a guy who thought nobody would read it, which is it sometimes allows us to be a little more, you know, aspirational. He said something in an interview recently that just stuck with me. He said that if you look back at the 20th century, the stories that the governments of, you know, the leaders of the United States, even the Soviet Union, you know, the UK, if you look at all of them, as bizarrely, as different as they were, they all told a story of a future that we were in. You know, there was a place for blue-collar workers. There was a place for people that worked hard. You didn't have to be something special or something elite. You didn't have to know how to, like, code or do these really high-powered, like, you know, jobs that have require specific skill sets. There was room for, you know, somebody like me when I was born, which is just a poor white kid in the country. And, like, there was a story that you fit in the future. And now the future is really hard for a lot of people to imagine themselves in, because it seems like it's headed in a direction that a lot of people in America don't belong in. And I think that, you know, taking from that, if you try to tell your stories as one in which everyone belongs, and this is kind of the key to the story anyway, if you tell a story that everybody can imagine themselves in, that's the best story, right? A story where you can fit in, and not a story where you immediately wall off half the people in the room because you lean on some difference, but you imagine some story that everyone can be a part of, whether it's from the past, whether it's in the present. But I think, I just can't help but feel like if there were people telling more stories about how this country was going to go and create a world in which we all belonged, at this point, I feel like that would be really, really compelling.
It's so interesting, because I think that, okay, this is something I just got. I was on Facebook, and someone sent me a tweet, a message that said, "I'm concerned." And then there was a picture of a George Jetson, and apparently he was born 3 days ago. So the Jetsons.
Yeah, the cartoons.
The Jetsons, the cartoons. He was born 3 days ago, apparently, based on his profile. So we're going to be, like, I don't know, flying around little spaceships. The Jetsons, they're coming. What, he was 40 years old or something? Our future, what is it going to look like? We have no idea.
Yeah.
If someone had shown up 30 years ago with an iPhone, we would have thought they were a wizard. We don't have any way to know what's coming, because the kids today, those little whippersnappers, they have dreamt of stuff that we didn't even think about. You know, we don't have any way to know where they're going, but we can think of a world in which they can do it. You know, I remember one of the things that I've talked to when I teach elementary school as an artist. One of the things I'm most worried about are kids who don't think outside the box, because they're going to have to figure out how to live with all the stuff that's coming. And sometimes our educational system doesn't help them until they get to almost middle school. We need to think about how to take what we have into the future, but how can we? Because who can see it? So maybe George Jetson is the right thing.
I don't know. This has never occurred to me before, but it's just kind of synthesizing this. In the 50s, kids grew up like getting underneath desks because they were like, we're probably going to get hit with a nuclear weapon any day now. They grew up in the world of the height of the Cold War. Like, they're all out to get you, you know? And they were like, but don't worry, in 50 years, it's going to be awesome. We'll be flying around in spaceships, time travel.
Flying cars.
Yeah, and today, like, I mean, the threat of like annihilation by like nuclear, it's possible. But, you know, I think I was the last kindergarten I climbed under the desk, you know? But now kids don't do that. It's like the existential threats to us right now that are like immediate and could happen, I feel like we live with those less heavily on us. And yet the future we imagine now is like everything's going to be on fire.
Or we're all going to be hooked up to machines and our little consciousnesses are going to be floating around in avatars or some crazy stuff like that.
So this wasn't supposed to be a think session.
No.
So I'm just thinking out loud here. I think how weird it is, I guess.
You heard it here first, everyone. It's live stream too, so.
Sorry.
What's up, internet?
Who has a question for Donna or Ben? I have plenty. Please go to the mic. We want to hear from you.
That just went someplace I didn't expect it to be.
It's always
the beauty of this session.
Flying cars.
Freewheeling.
Thank you. Hello?
Did you get the batteries from here and put them in?
Hello?
We can hear you.
But will the internet be able to hear you where it matters?
That's the important thing.
I know.
Hello, thank you. First of all, birds aren't real. also, thank you for the applause. Also, I was thinking as you all were talking about yesterday and discussing the frog brain, the limbic system, and we all know that stories that really spark that region of our brain, sometimes those stories are fear-based. And that we stoke fear in order to get action. What is the way through story to either reverse engineer that or short circuit the fear so that we can get to the hope, so that we can get to the collaboration, so that we can get past that fear to working together, to being all included in a story?
I would love to say that you can short circuit it, but you kind of have to go through it. Someone asked me earlier, like, you know, what happens, you know, I say this, I'm trying to talk to them and they're running away from me or they're angry. And I was like, acknowledge that that's happening, first of all, and understand that it's coming from a place usually of, you're saying that something I'm doing is wrong. You're challenging me. You're saying I'm wrong or I'm bad or something. They didn't get there just that second. That is repeated exposure to whatever is making them afraid. So if it's a question of continuing to try to get through to them and using different language, sometimes it's the words themselves that are causing them, because it's the freak out, right? It's your automatic freak out. You can't do anything about it, it's automatic. If you could even, when my husband and I needed to argue when our kids were little, we had a talking pepper. It was like the hot peppers from the cabinet. One would get it and hold on to it. And as long as you hold on to it, you could speak. And the other person had to listen to you. And then you could get it and you could speak. But it meant that you couldn't run away or yell or anything. You had to sit there. And it's uncomfortable and nobody wants to be uncomfortable. You can't always short circuit the angry. You just sometimes have to let it be and then try to talk through it. If you try to keep circumventing it, you never actually stop it. When you talk to someone and you hit one of their limbic systems, you ping, you often see this. They are protecting themselves and they're angry and they're not listening to you. Or everything you say, they're challenging. Yeah, everything's fine. Continuing to talk, keeping your voice kind of level, and then asking them questions while that's happening, a lot of times involving them in whatever you're talking about can also lower that level. But understanding as soon as you ping off, if you match that, it's just going to get worse. And also understand that maybe they can't hear you at that moment. And sometimes, I don't know, you've all had this where you've had an argument with someone and you've walked away and thought, oh, they had a good point. But sometimes in the middle of that, you really cannot hear them. So try to be respectful. If they start, you can say, I know you're upset. I didn't mean to set this off. But you have to get through it. Sometimes going around is not an option.
I think the way I teach my classes with history, I feel like there's a process you go through, at least for me, was you get the history that you learn in your classrooms and you go, everything's awesome, we're the best. And then you dig into history and you find out about all the dark moments, right? And there's a moment where like that's all, you're like, all the things you haven't heard about are just like, ah. And you have this, you know, hopefully short-lived idea. You're like, it's all bad, it was all a lie. And then if you keep studying, you come out the other end, and you realize that every person has light and dark in them. Every person has the potential for greatness. Every person has the potential to fall and make mistakes. And we live in a democracy. And in a democracy, we are the conglomeration of all of these people, not just now, but have come before us, making good decisions, making bad decisions, having their shining moments, having their fallen moments. And you look at the whole sum of it, and you start realizing things could have gone really wrong a lot of times.
They did.
And they did. No doubt. But they could have gone, I mean, there's so many more. So many more times. And you, what I think you have to do is go, if someone has an optimistic view of history, the thing I'll say to them is, like, that's good, but, like, you'd love, people say they love their country, right? They love this country. I do. Okay? But if you say you love this country and you don't actually know its history, it's like seeing somebody's, you know, dating profile and telling somebody you're in love with them. It's like you realize you're only seeing the pictures they want you to see, right? I think then true love only comes when you realize the other person has flaws and you learn to love the person in spite of the flaws. As I tell my students, true love only comes when you find out she snores and you still cuddle up tight. And that to me is in it. Despite all our flaws in the past, it's like all the times that things could have gone worse. And I think that's something we can all agree upon. You hear people saying, well, it's bad. Okay, yeah, but like you get to say that right now. In some places you don't. And people who say it's good, okay, but can we acknowledge that there's injustice in the past? Because if you don't understand that, if you think that like this country just boom, blew up, just season one is an expansion team, broke off of some other team that didn't want them to leave, and just won the Super Bowl every year. And nobody likes a character like that. Those aren't even real characters, right? I think when you go back on it and you realize, you know, this country is great because people made it great and we have the potential to do that. And we didn't always do it when we should have. But people fought and they sacrificed. And as I tell my students in my classes, my bias is I want you to appreciate this inheritance we have. I want you to appreciate, you know, even if you still have a negative attitude, I want you to appreciate these things. And they look at me like, that's not a bias that you love the country. I'm like, if I walked in here and said I hated the country, you'd probably walk out. You know what I'm saying? It is a bias. But nevertheless, it's one that I think when you find the times that things could have been worse, or as I tell them in a nutshell, I say, my father was born in 1945. And my father was born, segregation was legal. When my son was born, we had a black president. That's a hell of a swing for three generations.
How about this? When I was born, I couldn't have married my husband. We were born the year the Lovings versus Virginia was settled. So we were born the year it would have been legal for us to get married.
I've always said that I get to decide who loves each other.
Thank you. Next question.
Well, I'm glad we didn't call you.
Feel free to walk up to the mic if you
want. Yeah, I was just curious if you could give us a little insight about how you craft your stories. I know you said beginning, middle, end, but actually a little bit of like, you know, is there a big whiteboard where you just draw a lot of, you know, things on it? Is it just natural and you just kind of work on it in the shower and in your brain? Like just kind of, how does that actually come about? Because you're really great.
Every single person I have ever met talks about this differently. But basically, I'm an incredibly visual storyteller. So for me, it's all about what I see. And then I worry about what I want to convey based on the images that I see. So I do not write anything out completely. I never do. For instance, the way I put the piece that I did together yesterday is for about 4 months, I thought about all the stories I wanted to tell. And then once I picked more than I could do, I thought about what it is I wanted definitely to convey. And once I figured that out, some of those stories went away. And then I started figuring out how to get the stories I wanted to tell to fit into the categories I wanted to talk about. And what did I want to talk about? Good governance, what makes up good governance, what the stories politicians tell, how they affect people. And then I had to figure out all the stories that were going to make people trigger and get up and walk out of the room. And I cut those. Except for that one little moment. So once I figure out what I want to do, in my brain, I break the story down, the piece I'm going to do, down into its parts. This is when I want to say, I want to transition to this, I want to transition into this, I want to transition to this. And in every transition, I put a short story. So those are my cues that I'm talking about something else. So that's how I figure out when I've gone from the beginning of the story to the middle of the story to the end of the story. So I give my own myself verbal and visual cues to figure out where I'm going in which place. I also make sure that I say the things I want to say in each section. And then I just practice it. In the car, in the shower, at the grocery store. I'm the lady that talks to herself while I'm looking for beans. I'm that lady. And while I'm cleaning the house, while I'm doing anything. So in my downtime, I just run it. And then before I do it, I don't run it for 48 hours. Because I want the language to be natural. And the longer I practice something, the more it sounds like I practiced it. And then before I do it, some of you were in the room, I start visiting the tables of the people that were in the room. And I would ask, why are you here? And they said things to me. Some of it got incorporated into the talk. So a lot of it is reading an audience, seeing where they are as I do the thing that I'm putting together, and seeing what they need. I have been a professional storyteller for 35 years. It's the only job I have ever had. If that sounds like it's too much, just figure out what you want to say. You can write it out. But I never recommend that you read if you're going to be telling a story, because there's a difference between talking to people and sounding like you're reading to them. And if you sound like you're reading to them, they will disconnect from you at places. But if you're talking to them, they will keep engaged with you.
Then maybe a quick take, and we got a couple more questions about
Sorry.
Less than 10
minutes. My only quick take was one of my favorite parts about these NCSL summits is getting to come to this panel and hear Donna speak. So she's awesome.
Thanks for taking my question. This is a good segue. When you're telling a story, you just answered that. But when you're writing a story, is it more relatable to talk in the first person or the third person? Or does that not matter?
It doesn't matter. First or third, it doesn't matter. For me, anyway.
Hi. I've been thinking a lot about what you said about telling stories about other people versus telling stories about yourself. And I get that. And I would say two things that I would ask you about. I'm a physician in the rest of my life. And as a physician, we use normalizing language to talk to people about sensitive subjects, right? We say, a lot of us have times when we feel really down in the dumps, right? And we normalize it, and it's part of that bringing in, right? That connection and getting people to be part of a group. I have long believed as a legislator, I'm in a position of safety that a lot of people aren't have. So if I'm willing to talk about my experience with postpartum depression, or my experience with, you know, the challenges of having a newborn, or my experience with this, then other people are going to be able to talk about that, and they're going to be able to say, look, here's this woman who's really powerful and really well-educated, and she's willing to admit publicly that this is something she lives with. So I completely get and agree with your point about telling stories about other people and being inclusive and not talking about yourself a lot. I wonder if you could help me think a little bit about how to balance those two things and using our positions as public figures to talk about stuff that's hard to talk about publicly if we're comfortable doing so.
Wow, that's a really big subject.
Okay, sorry. You don't have to answer it. We can talk about it later.
We call that the hard story. I mean, that's just what we call them in the storytelling world. And the question is, how do you talk about physical abuse or anything like that? And a lot of times, the way I've seen it done well is you talk about, like, going through it as the story, usually from the third-person perspective in your own life, not first-person. And then you also bring in elements around it. Sometimes it's statistics, and it's a way of telling that hard story, but keeping the audience just far enough away from it so that they're not so horrified that they're not able to hear what you're trying to say. So if you want to talk about that more, I actually have a blog that I write, Language, Literacy, and Storytelling, and I do talk about the hard story, and there are storytellers who do it, and I'll talk to you later about how to hook up with them and get some information about that.
Yep, we have time for the last two questions. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. I actually want to revisit that one little moment from yesterday, but to ask if you could talk a little bit about the strategy or the risk reward of deliberately introducing friction into your audience and then trying to resolve that. Because when we had the discussion, when you started talking about, you know, the traditional family values, you spun the red lights, let us know it was coming, and so we all were kind of in a clinical brain and ready to take that and think about it and ponder on it. So the most organic reaction I heard in the room yesterday was when you started talking about Stone Mountain, because within earshot, I could hear different types of reactions. And then you were able to resolve that story the same way you resolved it in the moment when it really happened, which was with, you know, humor and getting through that, but allowing us to kind of sit in a place where we have to understand that there's some differences of opinion, but if we don't land the plane and get us back on the same page, you know, was it worth it? So maybe a little bit of ideas from you about how you do that successfully and how you navigate through that decision.
You guys want seminars, you know my answers. Just like I said to the first person who asked, when someone gets angry, when someone is triggered, how do you deal with that? The truth is, you have to go through it. And so when I introduce tension into an audience and they have that, then I said, who was expecting me to say that, right? So they have that moment, they're uncomfortable. The laughter is the release of that tension. So when you are trying, it's actually the same principle of telling ghost stories, where you where you take an audience up to a place and then you drop them, and your bodies will do the rest. Your bodies want to release that energy. So I give you an avenue to do it. But I'm also taking you slowly up the slope so that you know what I'm doing. So you are actively participating in the process of going to the uncomfortable place. You brace yourself, I take you to the uncomfortable place, and then I lead you out of it. I call it, you're the tour guide. And that's a whole other thing. And again, if you really want to know about that, sort of, I blog at at Language Literacy and Storyteller. And it talks about those kind of techniques.
Ben is our comedian. Do you want to say anything about that quickly?
Oh, I mean, this is the problem with being a historian, you know, is like, especially as a professor, it's like my job is not to tell anybody what to think, it's to deliver the information. So like I bring them up to the horrible point and then I go, all right, you guys figure it out. We'll see you on Wednesday. Because the problem is, I mean, not the problem, the beauty, but like the complexity of being a historian who, I firmly believe this, like you don't walk in a room and tell people what to think.
Yeah.
You don't. You alienate half the room and you're not doing your job.
Yep.
So you go in there and you say, look, there's going to be things, and I tell them, there's going to be things in the past that are going to make you hurt. And the only reason you hurt is because you love. And I want you to feel this, but you've got to figure out what the solution is. You got to figure out what to do about it. Do we need to do something or not? That's up to you. So I just get to do, yeah, just, we'll see you Wednesday. And also,
they won't hire me if I do that to people.
Last question.
Oh, thank you. I'm Harry Bhandari from State of Maryland, and thank you for sharing your experience. I really like the part you said about sense of belongings. And my experience is like, you can buy a lot of things, but you can't buy the experience that might make more authentic. When you were like, as an elected officer, when we are visiting like door to door, I do understand that there should be an instruction piece there, and there should be an inspiration piece, and there is an engagement piece as well. And whenever I say that, oh, I'm elected officer, people don't listen to me. When I say I'm not a politician, I'm actually an educator, they start listening. So my biggest challenge is that you need to knock so many doors in a day. You don't have that time luxury to explain everything, all these pieces. So are there any technique to tell your story in a very creative and memorable way in a short span of time?
That's a great question, because we have like 30 seconds for you to respond.
Short stories.
I mean, to catch somebody quickly, you're saying? I mean, when you're trying to convey yourself to someone, get across who you are, how do you do it quickly? I mean, yes. This is one of the things that I'll just say, like, I had to figure out I do so many history jokes as a comic, and when I was new, let me say, if you ever go on stage at a comedy club and you go, "Hi, I'm a history professor," everyone's like, "God, not you again." Oh my God, does this guy think he's smarter? But like the thing about comedy is being vulnerable, right? So like I wrote a misdirect joke that I still use it sometimes, and it's like, I'm a history professor, but I've got a Southern accent. So sometimes when I go other places, people wonder if I'm smart enough. And I just can't imagine that in today's world, people still think you've got to be smart to be a college professor, right? It's just a dumb misdirect joke, but it makes you vulnerable because you're making fun of yourself immediately. If you're trying to break down walls, I think like making yourself someone who's human enough to be joked about, like that works. It's kind of disarming, and that's worked for me.
I've got a short one I just learned 3 hours ago. So this woman, the grandmother, she makes a meatloaf. She cuts off the end of the meatloaf before she sticks it in the pan. And all throughout her family, everybody does this because it's the best meatloaf. And one year she doesn't cook anymore, she's sitting at the table, and she noticed that someone has cut off the end of the meatloaf. And she's like, "Why do you guys do that?" "Well, you do that." "Yeah, because my pan was too small." Think about what could have been learned, all the food they wasted, because they didn't learn the history of why she did that. So a short story about the importance of learning people's history in meatloaf.
With that, I'll close our time together. Please join me once again in thanking Don and Ben for being here.